Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Promoting peace, liberty, and prosperity around the clock. LibertyTalk.fm.
George, today I have a really special show on and someone I'm looking forward to speaking with. We're going to talk with Mr. Miles Wakeham, and he has a really interesting website. He's a podcast host, he's an author, and people should go to beunconstrained.com. And today we're going to be talking about our future, our economic future. We're in the midst of this pandemic, whatever, this COVID situation. And the thing that really strikes me as an individual, as a solo practitioner, as a business owner, is that I'm not sure what my future holds. I'm trying to navigate what I think is going to happen, and I'm sure I'm not alone. And everything we hear on the news, it seems like a global issue economically. But we have power, and I think we have power in a lot of ways in our lives, and we just seem to cede it to whomever, whether that's the government, whether that's influencers telling us what we should think and how we should feel. But ultimately, the choice comes down to us, and we have to have personal responsibility. But I think you can't have it unless you have knowledge. And so today we're going to be speaking about what we can do and powers that we can take now and not depend on somebody else to control our future. And Miles, if I can call you that, I think we're friends now. We want to just really get down to the nitty-gritty. But first, let me know, how did you start off with this, down this path of being knowledgeable and taking your power back?
Well, firstly, thank you for having me on your show. I certainly appreciate it. I'm very unusual. And I say that in kind of a weird way because I call myself a contrarian. So that's only because I tend to do not the polar opposite of what everybody else does, but very much the opposite of what mainstream social teachings would have us believe. So in regards to your specific question, I'm originally from Australia. You probably hear that in my accent. I spent the first half of my life growing up with the economies of Australia, with the culture, with the way in which, you know, a person is expected to act and behave and all those sorts of things, which is a country which is predominantly a sort of a democratic socialist country, much like many, many nations in Europe, in which the government is involved in every single thing you do, whether you like it or not, from your education to going into business to everything. There's a government, almost like a partner, in the background somewhere, sort of making sure you do the right thing, whatever that is. And I think that was the genesis of me questioning what everyone was telling me, because I was living this very atypical life compared to all of my friends, and it ended up working out for me. And I couldn't work out why I was doing so well at a very young age and they were still struggling. And then at the age of 25, I boarded a plane and I came to the United States with nothing. And I left the United States 5 years later as a very wealthy millionaire, multimillionaire. And I ended up going back to Australia for about 4 years. I had to take care of my mother. She was at the end of her life, and I, you know, did what a son has to do, I guess. And eventually I came face to face in Australia with a lot of the AB opportunities, and comparing what I knew I'd been raised with in terms of social mantra and social culture and so on, what I had learned traveling the world, and then to bring it back and realize how it just did not fit. For one reason or another, 4 or 5 years later, after my mum had passed, I returned back to the United States and I did it all over again. And it was a great experience. And I went through 2008 like everybody else did at the time, and ever since then. And I constantly tried to compare what I was doing with why it was working for me, but it wasn't working for all of my friends. And that's what came upon the whole. I literally just got sick and tired of saying the same thing, telling the same story, preaching the same mantra to everybody as I was encountering them, because they would come to me and go, oh, I can't afford my health insurance, or I can't afford my rent or my mortgage, or I'm never going to retire and there's no hope for me. And I looked at it and I go, do you realize the opportunities that you've got right in front of you right now that you are squandering, wasting your time whining to me about all these things? You could be out there and seizing the moment. But what I started realizing after the frustration of going through that over and over again was that nobody gave them the raw material that they needed to be able to use that would make them millionaires, multimillionaires. And then I saw this pattern. I saw, why is it that all new millionaires in this country, and I'm not talking about the people who made their money on Wall Street or, you know, investing in index funds or whatever in a bull market. I'm talking about real hardcore business people who work and they hustle and they do what's needed. Why is it the vast majority of these people are immigrants? And that's where I started to see why. And that's what drove me to inventing a methodology or constructing a methodology, codifying a methodology that would do this, and then putting the beunconstrained.com website together and putting a podcast together and so on. And it's been this kind of roller coaster journey ever since.
Well, you say something that's really dear to my heart, and that is you came here with hope and with nothing but an idea and your hard work. And it's like, I think sometimes Americans, we just don't really get that. My dad was an immigrant as well, came with nothing and created something because he had the ability to think and say, nothing's going to stop me. And this is a really interesting country. There's a lot of ways to be successful. But I think especially now we're being kind of pushed out of that mindset. Like, there's a problem with thinking, I don't want anybody's help. I want to do it on my own. And there's nothing, I'm not taking it from somebody else. I'm just creating my own. Because it's being successful is not a bad word, is it?
It's not, but there are many challenges that everybody is going to, regardless of where you've come from or your background, where you were born. There are challenges that we all face that are global and are significant, that we can't ignore, and we have to have a strategy for those. And then there are strategies that there are challenges that we self-impose. And oftentimes we self-impose these things because of a collective herd-like mentality. And often we never question what that herd-like mentality is until it's too late. I like to start from that point and move through the whole process of life and understanding what I've learned now that I'm in my, you know, mid-50s. Mm-hmm. I look back at everything that I did wrong and I look back at everything I did right, and I'm able to have that transcendence experience to be able to sort of look and somewhat self-actualize, or whatever they call that in psychology, I don't know, but to be able to look back and say, okay, these are the things that I needed to master at this point in time, and I needed to lock them down. And then from that, I had a foundation to build up from. I'm being very high level, and to your listeners, a lot of this stuff might make no sense at all until I bring some real life paradigm, real life examples to bear. But this is probably a good starting point for us to have the conversation anyway.
I like that. And let's take our first break so that we can jump right back in on that note. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Miles Wakeham. He is an author. He is the podcast host of Be Unconstrained. And before the break, we were talking about collectivism versus individualism, maybe. And what's the groundwork? What's the commonality that you think that people need to, whatever their walk of life is, that they need to have the first grain of to start down this different path?
Okay. The easy place to start is a simple statement that I use called the four quarters of life. And you begin by looking at your life and you break it down based on a whole bunch of statistics and information, which is readily available and out there on the internet that anybody can find. And it all for me began at an observation that the average US, and I'm going to go with US males in this case. Obviously, the numbers are different for females and they're different in different parts of the world as well. But the average US male life expectancy as of 2016, I believe, or 2018, was 79.3 years. So keep that number in mind. Let's call it 80 because it's easier to think in terms of breaking this up. And so what I did was I looked at an 80-year-old life and I realized if we break this up into four quarters, each quarter is kind of a chapter in a story and it leads from one into the other. And it's not a perfect science, but it's as good as I can simplify. The first quarter of our lives, we're taught to learn. We're taught to communicate. We're taught to walk. We're taught to understand where boundaries are. We're taught to learn how to learn. And we go through that whole process until roughly the age of 20, in which we're sort of kicked out of the nest into the real world and we have to try and find a place for ourselves. And this is not uncommon in nature. It's common with most other species that this is what happens. And that second quarter is what I call the building quarter, the building phase. In that quarter, which is the age 20 to 40 in one's life, we do things, we build things. We build a life, we build a career, we build an identity, we build a house, we build a family. We build a sense of who we are, what we believe in, and it is from that that we have some sort of a foundation that we can move into our third quarter, which I call the optimization phase. This is a quarter where we've hit that midpoint in life, and people often talk in terms of like midlife crises and things like that. I don't think of those as crises. I think that what you're doing is you're over the top of the mountain. On the other side of the mountain, you know there will be less years ahead of you than were in your rearview mirror. But of those years, you have so much to bring to it because you have wisdom and talent and maturity, and that those things can make those last sort of two quarters of your life a wonderful experience. So in that third quarter, we typically do things like we go out there and like squirrels, we gather nuts for the looming winter, which is our final quarter. We optimize what we've got. We look to our kids and we put them into college and them into their life experience. So we move them into their second quarter gradually. We look at ourselves and we think in terms of what have we learned? What can we give back? What can we bestow upon everybody else that is wisdom that will help them get through the challenge of life easier? And then you get to the end of that third quarter and you're in your final chapter. It's like a waning phase. You're looking down the barrel at the age of 60 or so, and you realize that, you know, you're a biological organism and your body's going to wear out. It's not unlike an old car. It's going to hurt. It's going to have aches and pains, and you're going to go through more experiences with the medical system that you've ever had in the past, and hopefully, and that at some point in time, you're going to die. And that's a horrible, morose, depressing idea, but it's natural because we all have to allow the new growth to come forward and have its chance to. And so this is part of that final quarter. You see, in all parts of life, there's something that we can see this from a human, emotional, psychological feeling position. But just as we can do that, there's also somebody over there with a suit and tie on in an office and an actuary table who's looking at this from a banker's perspective, from an insurance company's perspective. And they look at it and they go, our business model is to extract money from other people for doing nothing, for no expenditure of labor. We will give money to somebody on the pretense that they will pay back that money with interest. And the interest is our profit. It's our cash flow. And this model's been around, you know, for thousands of years, but it is the model we live in. And those people in the suits and ties are looking at your four quarters of life and they're going, how do I get you in as early as possible on debt? And how do I ride this thing out as long as possible so that we get the maximum amount of interest payments over the course of your four quarters of life? Well, There's one problem they've got, and that is that you as an individual are not allowed to sign a legal agreement, a contract, until the age of 18. So what do? At the age of 18, they're pummeling you with credit card offers and all those sorts of things, and we've all seen that. But also, they're trying to hold you in front of a college admissions process, and they're laying in front of you a contract that you may have to sign that says that you will pay back all this student loan money and that you can't defer it. There's no escape. There's no bankruptcies. There's nothing. You've got to pay that money back. And it could be $100,000. It probably will be $100,000 if you look at rates of inflation and so on. When you factor those things in, we've got an 18-year-old sign a contract and they're not allowed to go to the bar and buy a beer yet in most states. Yet they're expected to sign a $100,000 debt obligation that begins their journey through the next three quarters of life. And as you perpetuate the numbers and you realize just how long it's going to take to pay that off, that delays their ability to go and get in their building phase and buy a house and pay a mortgage off, because they're now holding two notes, two debt obligations, and now they've got twice the amount of capital or cash flow going out the door. And they probably want a car, and they probably need to get a car loan for that, and they probably need to furnish their place, and they've got all these store credit loans, and they get a credit card because one day they don't have enough money for the month, and so they put it on a credit card. And this stuff starts stacking up and stacking up and stacking up. And the idea is that by the end of the second quarter of their life, by the age of approximately 40 or so, they are so inundated with debt, and there's no hope. At this point, they've refinanced their house 15 times over. They've used it as an ATM machine to pull money out. And now all of a sudden, they realize they've got 20 years until that 60-year-old number comes around, or 65 or whatever it may be. And in that 20 years, they've got to pay off the student loan. They've got to pay off the house. They've got to pay off all the cars, because the one rule which is still true is that you may never retire if you have debt. You are going to be on that working treadmill until the rest of your life paying that debt off, unless you get rid of it. Then at the age of 60, 65, we look at the number of people who are capable of retiring at that point in time, and it is less than 50%. And we look at the statistics of somebody going through that life, and 78%, this is according to Forbes magazine, 78% of those people are living paycheck to paycheck. Their expenses exceed their income every month. So how do they bridge the gap? Well, they use the credit card. They further the bank interest paradigm all the way through. When I looked at all of this as somebody, like, take a 1,000-foot view. Let's assume you're not part of somebody's story and you're looking over it. What would the average person think? Well, the first thing is you begin at the very genesis of the problem, the student loan debt. And if you could get rid of that, then maybe that person could get some traction. Maybe they could get some purchase. Maybe they could get some inertia going forward that would enable them to be able to have a chance that by their third quarter, they're not going to be inundated with debt and they have a chance to save their money to protect them through their fourth quarter. Now, here's your problem. Most 20-year-olds will never listen to a guy like me tell them to do that, because they're immortal. They don't know. They'll go and do whatever they want. Unless it's somebody telling them to do that on TikTok or Instagram, they're not going to listen to me. Problem is, by the time they start realizing they should have, it's too late, because against their grain and attacking them at all angles are the billboard signs on the side of the road telling them that they're not worthy to live an existence in the middle class in the United States unless they've got the American Express Platinum Card, or the next one down there tells them they should be driving the new Ford truck, and the one after that's telling them that they could upgrade to the better house, and the one after that's telling them in order to make sure all of this is safe, they've got to sign thousands of dollars of insurance premiums away. All this sort of thing is against their very interest. And I sort of take the attitude of, like, don't look at the billboards. And if you want to look at social paradigms, maybe we as a society have a responsibility to our own going forward, that maybe they don't all have to go to college. Maybe they should at least as we as parents, knowing this in advance, if we cannot fund them into that, then we need to find a way that they can generate it themselves. And the one problem I've got is a big one, which came from somebody who, you know, comes from a foreign country and looks at these things and questions them. And I see this 63% statistic number. The number is 63% of most college graduates are not doing what their degree was for in any way, and look back upon it in regret, realizing they, if they had a second choice, they would have chosen to study X or to do Y. And the reason for that, it's the same reason why an 18-year-old kid has no business signing a $100,000 mortgage until they've gone out and they've had a chance to live a life. And that's what I had. I was expected, and this is a very common thing in Europe too, I was expected at the end of high school to go out and spend a year or two traveling the world as a backpacker and find myself. I was expected to begin the building phase of identity first before I built debt, because nobody finds their identity in a bank mortgage, and nobody finds their identity when an institution is telling them what to do, how to think, how to act, where they actually made the choice of the wrong institution to go into because they didn't know who they were yet. The problem we have, and this is again, I bring forward an immigrant's perspective. The problem we have is we as parents bestow our own fears onto our children, and we do it through our direction. We believe that every kid should have a job and every kid should have a chance and an education and opportunities should be, you know, available to everybody. But we know it's not like that.
Mm-hmm.
So what we do is we end up pushing forward our hopes and our fears onto our children and believing that a banker, a student loan debt, a federal government, anybody will look after that kid in our absence. It doesn't happen that way. What we have to do is we have to say to our kids, find yourself. Go out, travel the mountains of Nepal. Go out to the Andes. Go out to Alaska and work on a fishing boat. Go out and find yourself. And when you've found yourself, come back and we'll have a conversation then about what you want to do with yourself going forward into the next three quarters of your life. If that conversation was honestly ever had, we would not be having a lot of our societal problems today.
I think you make an excellent point. And, you know, I'm a little unusual. I guess every physician or everybody who wants to be a professional kind of knows what they want to do. So we didn't have a chance or didn't want to just stop. But if you have other dreams that aren't as rigid as healthcare or medicine, it makes perfect sense to get out there and live a little, because you actually can't do it when you're going straight through and you're letting something outside define your worth or being part of a group or part of a whole. You have to have your own sense of self. On that note, let's take our second break. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. We're speaking with Mr. Wakeham, and Miles, before the break, you made a lot of excellent points. And, you know, I never really thought about that because I was one of those kids that was driven. I just knew what I wanted to do and I did everything to get to my goal. And I delayed gratification, and I'm glad I did. It worked for me, but it doesn't work for everybody. And the fact that you're a debt slave so early in life, your choices are literally, they're stripped from you, aren't they? I mean, if you're always trying to pay back something, how do you live your best life?
Well, what they're asking you to do is to sell your future to them. Mm. Now, and literally that is what it is, because the reality is, and I speak to so many people on a regular basis about this, that they might be, say, 35, they've got a young family, and I'll speak to them and they'll say to me things like, we have lost hope. Because we want to spend time with our kids. We want to be able to go to the dance classes and watch them at the recitals and so on. But, you know, father or mother is getting pulled away to work in the corporate cubicle because they have to. The boss doesn't care that they've got a family. The boss has got their quotas and their targets to meet. And at the end of the day, unless they sign up for somebody else's dream, their own has to be put aside. And I don't ever think that people need to live in regret like that, because at the end of the day, why did they take that job? Well, because they wanted to follow the social paradigm of study hard, get a good job, save, and one day you'll retire. Well, let me tell you a little story about my father. Grew up through World War II. I guess he was about 20 when he was in World War II, something like that. He didn't go to war. He actually had an accident in a carpentry factory where he lost two of his fingers, and one of them happened to have been on a circular saw, and one of them happened to be a trigger finger. So he got out of the serving in the military. As a result, he worked for a roofing company for 40 years, a big corporation in Australia that did large-scale roofs on houses. And at some time, I guess I was about 10 years old, so I guess this was – I guess he was probably about 50. He was a foreman out there in the on site. He loved going out in the sunshine. He loved being outdoors, and he loved the people he worked with. And I could see that. You know, I could see it in his eyes all the time. He was happy. But one day he fell off a roof, and this happens. You know, it's a high-risk job. He was very lucky he didn't have any permanent damage, he didn't fall on anything that would have hurt him. But what it did was it sent a scary message to the insurance company of the corporation that you better get this guy off a roof. He's had one accident. We don't want to be liable. So they took him off the roof, and they put him in the laboratory, in the lab at the corporation. Well, as it happened, he worked there for the next 15 years of his life and then retired at the age of 65. He lived 2 years and died. At the age of 65, he did what most retirees would want to do. He did the trip to Europe with my mother, and they spent about 6 or 8 weeks traveling around Europe, had a great time. But he was sore and physically disabled, and he couldn't really enjoy the whole process. He came home and he had these problems with his lungs. He couldn't, he was coughing all the time. Sometimes he even was coughing up blood, and we didn't know why. Well, eventually we found out he had lung cancer. But the interesting thing is how he got it. He worked for a company that made asbestos products, and he was in the lab completely surrounded with blue asbestos, which was a carcinogen. And they knew that. And they were using him to try to reduce the amount of the carcinogenic product of their product, their roofing tile, and replace it out with some sort of synthetic version of that. But they never told him that. And when he died, we didn't know what was going on. This is going back a long time. I was 22. I had to ID the body. I had to do the whole, you know, sun thing and deal with the funeral and put him to rest and all of that. But at the end of the day, what lesson I got from this was, why would you give 40 years of your life to a corporation that doesn't care about you, that wants to sacrifice you to cover their own butt, and had demonstrated that on multiple occasions? And then at the end of the day, for your wonderful, you know, 65-year retirement, they give you the gold watch, they give you the 401k or whatever the equivalent is, and then you go off into the sunset and you're dead 18 months later. So I spent a little bit of my time studying this phenomenon. And what I found out was that the BBC made a very interesting publication on a thing called the Boeing study. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of this.
Mm-mm, no.
Okay. Boeing, a big company that makes a lot of aircraft and defense contractors and so on, and they offer a pension plan to their workers. Well, in order to know how much money they need to fund the pension plan, they have to look at the life expectancy of their workers. And when they did this, they published their study transparently, which was wonderful. But this is a study that's been refuted by the mainstream financial industry over and over again. I'm going to explain why. But the interesting thing about the Boeing study is that they realized that when somebody retires at the age of 55 years old, they have an average life expectancy until the age of 83, as mm-hmm. proven by pension payments, like how long are they paying the pension. But if the person works until the age of 65, the average life expectancy of pension payments is only 2 years.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot of wow. But then I looked at my own father and then I realized, oh, That's exactly what happened to him. So I happened to be giving this speech to a group here in Phoenix. I live in Arizona. And I happened to be in front of this group and I said this thing and I got the same wow response from the group. And then after I'd finished the speech, a lady came up to me and she said to me, I guess she was in her 60s, and she said, you know, I really connected when you told about the Boeing study. I'm like, oh, okay. And she introduced herself. She was somebody who was the CFO for, I guess I can say it, Honeywell, another large military defense contractor, make airplane parts and so on. She said, we at Honeywell did the exact same study and came up with the identical numbers Boeing had. Identical. So this is common knowledge. Mm-hmm. But if you go out and you speak to anybody who works for Charles Schwab or Fidelity or Vanguard or any of these big retirement, you know, investment type companies, they will absolutely destroy that argument as being, oh, that's the urban myth, that's conspiracy stuff, that's not real. Why? Because they're bankers. They want you there as long as possible to continue to pay fees and so on and to have your wealth, so that they don't care whether they've got your wealth and you only live for 2 years, as long as they can churn it. And what I'm seeing is this pattern over and over and over again of society being set up where nobody is willing to say, this is the honest truth. This is how a life is worth living. This is what a life is about. And it doesn't matter your belief system, your ideology, that's irrelevant. When it comes to economics, we're all on the same playing field. The difference is whether or not we're given access to opportunity as equally. And I'm a huge proponent of equal access to opportunity. At the same time, I'm also a huge proponent that if you screw up with the opportunity, that's on you. Mm-hmm. But everybody should be given the same chance. One thing that I was taught at a very young age is the simple formula of life, where success equals preparedness meeting opportunity. So if you are prepared, you're a good student of what you do, so you can take advantage of it. You've got the right tools. You're available at the right time. You're not encumbered. When the opportunity comes to you, you can maximize it, and that's what success is. And to each individual, the success might be a McMansion or a new boat or a Ferrari or whatever. You define what you think success is. I don't personally believe in those sorts of things, but everybody needs something that gives them hope. Everybody needs something that drives them towards it. But everything that's being that pulls you away from that journey is all of those decisions you made in your past where you sold your future out to a bank. What I try to teach people is a concept I call financial sustainability. And it's very much an embracement of no debt and one simple thing that is a paramount within wealthy people, a simple statement that everybody forgets. It's never taught in school. It's never taught in college. It's never discussed anywhere, but it's a simple, universally accepted paradigm of the wealthy. And it goes like this. The rich don't have jobs. That's it. If you embrace that, it tells you everything. The rich don't have jobs. I'll tell you what the rich do. The rich own things. They own assets. The assets could be a business. It could be real estate. It could be precious metals. It could be fine art. It could be shares, stocks, bonds. It could be Forex. It could be whatever it is. They own these assets. And they derive their wealth from the dividends or the rents that are generated from the assets. And that's the key. A lot of people call these things passive income. That's not telling the truth. That's not in any way telling the truth. If you own assets and you can generate income from assets, you will never work another day in your life. And then one thing happens, and this is a really, really key part of it. The word retirement is stripped out of your vocabulary. You never talk about retirement. because you never worked a day in your life in the first place. And that's the lesson that I learned maybe 5-10 years ago that turned everything around for me. Because if I look down the barrel of saying, well, I've got to, you know, go to school until I'm 22 or whatever it is, and then get a job and work hard and build a family and a life and save. And when I'm 40 or 45, I can begin starting worrying about putting all my money in the Vanguard Index Fund or whatever, so that when I get to that 65 years, I can retire. Yeah, well, everything I've told you tells you that that 65 years gives you 2 years to enjoy that money. And then the problem is that doesn't work. And also, if you were to find a way where you never had to retire in the first place, you're probably going to extend your life expectancy if you take into consideration the Boeing study. Because at the age of 55, one is young enough still mentally to transition from a world of being responsible to the corporation, to the employer, to the boss, when to turn up for work, when to go home, all those sort of things. You detach from that and you take that on board yourself. And yet you're at an age where you can adjust. It's not easy. I don't know anybody who would ever agree that it would be easy. It's not. Everybody thinks of, oh, retirement, I'm going to go to the Bahamas and live on a beach for the next. No, you're not. You're going to do that for 6 months and be bored out of your skull. Okay. Yeah. You're going to want to have a new chapter. You're going to want to have a new adventure. And the point is, at 55, you probably have time left to do that. But at 65, you don't. And that's why a mindset of depressive, there's no hope, what am I going to do, watch my grandkids grow up, and that's why you don't live very long. The parallel between mental health and a willingness and embrace of a passion for life, a passion to achieve something, to have adventures, to go out and do things, is what makes us live forever. And it's that thing that you don't get if you buy into this stupid social paradigm of retiring at the age of 65. So my teaching, what I do with the whole concept of what I call financial sustainability, is to find a way that you can own assets, generate enough income from the assets to cover your cash flow needs, what you need every month, what we call your burn rate, and you can live frugally to begin with, but you can end up living, you know, lifestyles of the rich and famous later if you've got enough assets. Mm-hmm. But you don't have to have all those assets. You can have a few rental properties and live a good life. You can have some vending machines and live a good life. You can have some internet website and live a good life. As long as it's generating you rent, it's generating you a dividend, you can do it. And if you've got that money and you know what your burn rate is, find peace that one will cover the other. And as long as it's inflation-proof, you are good to go. And real estate ticks all the boxes for us, but there are many, many other ways of doing it. And you don't need to have a lot of money to buy real estate because you only need to put down a small percentage. You don't have to have the whole amount of the money of the asset that you're purchasing, unlike stocks where you have to buy the whole thing. In real estate, you buy a portion of it, but you get the benefit of the whole thing. And there's, look, I'm not going to try and get into that because I sound like a 3 a.m. infomercial salesman. I'm not interested in that. That doesn't matter. What matters is that you find a formula that generates you enough dividend income, enough rental income, enough cash flow to cover your burn rate, and you keep your burn rate as low as possible, and then that removes the need for you to ever have to retire ever again because you're not working. The assets are doing all the work. With all of that wonderful new time and availability you've got, you can then have your adventures, and you can do that as young as possible in life if you don't screw it up at the age of 18 and sign a debt contract away.
Well, let's take our last break because I want to ask you, if you've gone down that path of becoming a debt, you know, debt encumbered, how do you work your way out of that?
Okay.
So let's answer that question when we come back. You're living in the solution. Welcome back to Living the Solution. Before the break, we were talking and you eloquently laid out what we should be striving for, which is peace of mind and freedom. But, you know, as you mentioned at the beginning of our show, a lot of people, many people have gone down a path where they are in a debt trap. How do you make that move? Now we have a mindset of there's something bigger than us and something better out there. How do we work our way I mean, mindset aside, because that's important, but physically and mechanically, what can we start doing to release ourselves from this yoke?
Well, one thing I believe that happens whenever there's some sort of an adverse event in anybody's life, whether it be something you have control over or something you do not. And, you know, as we're recording this, we're going through a global pandemic, so we can kind of call that an adverse event. But it's a good illustration of how humans handle these situations. We find ourselves in a tough situation. We don't know what's going on. We don't know what's up, what's down. We're all isolated. We're all confused. But you know what? The day will come where a vaccine emerges and those problems disappear and we go back to our normal life again. When that happens, we will do one thing, which is universally always the case in human history. We will look back and debrief the situation. We will look at what worked. We will look at what didn't work. We will try to codify that and capture the history because we don't want to repeat it again. But unfortunately, wired into our DNA is that we will repeat it again, just as we've done that with wars and we've done that with empire and we've done that with everything in our past. We are doomed to repeat our own history. That's normal. But there is that little window of time, that glimmer of hope in which you get to debrief that you never want to go through that ever again. That is important for somebody who is living in a world of debt to go through. Often people call it, you know, when it's in a group setting, they call it like an intervention. But I look at it as a personal debrief. You have to realize that you're responsible for signing those contracts. Nobody put a gun to your head to sign it. And you might think, well, you know, how else am I going to have, you know, live in a nice neighborhood if I can't afford the mortgage on it? And how else do I send my kids to the right school and all this sort of thing? I'm sorry, but they're choices. You didn't have to do any of them. No one put a gun to your head. Learn that with the choice, with the great power you were given with that debt money was the responsibility to pay it back. And if you're unable to pay it back because some lender was not interested in your best interests, your well-being, but more their commission, then yeah, they're part of the problem. But you knew that going into it, right? You knew there were these sleazy salespeople trying to make a commission. Well, you know, who's responsible? So step number one is a willingness to accept responsibility, because the worst thing that could happen here is that we fix the debt problem and then you just do it all over again. The unfortunate reality is that most people who live life with a hole in their pocket and they can't keep any money before they go down to the casino and lose it, or they go and buy something they can't afford, they're going to do it again and again and again. That's why so many people who win the lottery are not ever happy. They are, you know, having come face to face with the fact that they never had enough money in their lives, and all of a sudden they've got more than they can ever spend. It's a transition that is not unlike what my father went through when he retired. And it's the same thing. We mentally have to adjust to these situations. Well, the best thing you can do if you're saddled with debt is you're going to have to go and do the Dave Ramsey thing. You're going to have to go and you're going to have to do the beans and rice, and you're going to have to get rid of everything, and it's going to hurt. Just like pulling off a Band-Aid would hurt. You made the mistake. You're going to have to sort of put on the big boy or big girl pants and take care of this thing, because that's how it works. If you take control and you take responsibility for this, and most importantly, you learn, and we know psychologically we learn so much more during failure than we ever do during success. That's just normal. You need to have those scars etched in you that says, I will never let this ever happen again. All right, if you're willing to do that, then the next stage you need to do is to realize what you can pay and what you can't pay, and you may have to find a way to negotiate and possibly use a lawyer or use somebody to negotiate on your behalf and get those debt payments gone. And I'm not talking about get them down to, you know, project over a longer period. I'm talking about get the lender to completely write the thing off. And that might mean that you have to do a little bit of that art of negotiation where you walk away from the deal and go, well, I'm going bankrupt, lender, you'll get nothing. And then you go, okay, wait, let's make a deal. That's what you're going to have to do. and it's not nice, but why'd you do it in the first place? So anyway, I don't want to come across unempathetic to people's situations, but they have to realize that by signing up to the social contract that is the 21st century, go to school, work hard, get a good job, buy a house, all this stuff, they're trying to be that person, to try to be that, you know, ideal, the American dream or whatever we want to call it. It's not what it is. It's a Hollywood movie and it's not real. Real is you saving money and buying something with cash. Real is you deferring that gratitude. Real is you embracing frugality as a good thing and not something that, you know, only crazy people do. Good is you doing what you can to help society accept people who are contrarian, who are different. That means if you want to go out for dinner, don't expect to invite your frugal friend to come along. Why don't you just go out and find something where you have a meal at home and embrace them as friends and bring everybody to the table and no one spends any money or we all share it or it's very minimal. We have to, as a society, embrace frugality as part of our way forward, particularly right now, because right now we're coming off the hangover of 10 years of bull market. And that was normal. That was going to happen, pandemic or not. That was going to happen. We're going to go through that process of the bear market. You know,
Miles, we're at the end of our show, unfortunately. We just go so quickly. It's amazing. I have to have you come back because you only started with 2 points that we have to do, mm-hmm. which means that it leads to a segue of a next round. And I'd love to have you back on so that we can go into detail of how you fix the problem. And I think you're right. Personal responsibility has to be job number one and the courage to stand up for yourself, because what you just described is key for that. So in the meantime, how can people reach you? How can they listen to your podcast and find your website?
Well, everything starts at our website, which is at beunconstrained.com. From there, they'll be able to read articles and listen to our podcast episodes, subscribe to the podcast and so on. I have a book coming out and it will be out probably sometime about September this year. And it's called The Art of Financial Sustainability. And it gives you the absolute down to the details of things that one can do to try to make sure they don't fall into these traps and to build up their own strength and their own financial resilience so that they're in control. And that should be coming out soon. I'm going to be making announcements on the website regarding that.
If I can put my dib in now to have you back on when that book comes out, I'd love to have you back on to discuss it in detail.
Absolutely. I'd be more than happy to.
Awesome. And I want to thank everybody for living in the solution.
Revolutionary talk for revolutionary times. Liberty Talk FM.